My name's Greg, and I'm an alcoholic. I guess we'll start with what it was like. And what it was like was, I'm not from here. I'm from St. Louis. I come from a long line of alcoholic men. All the Dalton men are alcoholics, and we've been all alcoholics as long as I can remember. I grew up in the alcoholic family with my mother had been abused their whole marriage, and I remember the family up the street, the Shillings, you know. And to me, I grew up in the time when Beaver Cleaver, that was my favorite guy, you know. I love the Beaver. I love watching Beaver. And it seemed like their family was the Cleavers, you know, and ours was more like the Mondellos or the Haskells or somebody else. I mean, we weren't the Cleavers, that's for sure, you know. And I remember I kicked off my drinking career when I was 11 years old. What happened was I had a younger brother who was killed in an accident, and the whole family went into disarray. And I kind of ran away, but it wasn't really running away, because I just kind of floated away from the group, you know. And I remember the first thing I drank was MD 2020. And I thought it was a race. And I cracked open the second bottle of MD 2020. Thought I was a man at that point. And then I remember laying over the gas register at Pizza Hut. Ralph. I met Ralph for the first time, you know. And I woke up the next day, and I couldn't wait till the next weekend so I could do it again. There might have been a sign that was a problem, you know. And that's what it was like for me, you know. What happened was I missed the first couple days of seventh grade burying my brother. And that time in your life, that time for me was integral, you know. And I kind of lost my way. And what happened, you know, and it got really bad for my dad at that time also. And he was a heavy drinker, I was his shadow. My mom sent me with my dad everywhere we went, and I'm from St. Louis, and in St. Louis there's a tavern on every street corner, you know, and every street corner knew my dad, and they knew me, you know, because I was there with them. And I was always cleaning up and finishing off the beers and finishing off the mixed drinks and, you know, helping out everywhere I could, you know. And what happened was, Easter of that year, my father went into an alcoholic coma and he died. And so I spent that time of seventh grade burying my father, you know. And, you know, the family was in disarray and I was off and running, you know. And I hit a growth spurt, and all of a sudden I was 6 foot tall between seventh and eighth grade, and I was hanging out with the older kids because they knew how to get alcohol a lot easier than the guys that were 13, 14 years old. And, you know, I was the guy that would go into the store and steal three packs of spark plugs, because you got $8 for each one of those packages. And if you stayed under $25, they didn't take your information for some reason. And so I was stealing spark plugs from all over St. Louis, and we'd go get a bunch of beer and get hammered, you know. And that was the deal. And that's how it went, you know. I drank alcoholically from the beginning, and I knew that was my lot in life, and that's how the Daltons did it, and till the wheels fell off, you know. I had a brother that was a couple years older than me, and I saw the ravages of alcoholism for him. And it wasn't ever pretty, not from the beginning, you know. And what, you know, the next couple of years I was in a fog, you know, and drinking all weekend long, and then the weekends became from Thursday till Monday. And, you know, I just remember the one thing was, in our family, you had to graduate from high school. They didn't care how many charges you had filed against you. You just had to graduate from high school, you know. And, You know, I spent time in Missouri's version of CYA. You know, I spent a couple of years in Lakeside Boys Home. And that was a really interesting place. The night I actually got out of Lakeside Boys Home, I was 16 years old, and my brother picked me up, and we went downtown to the Admiral, which is a boat that rode down the Mississippi River, and we snuck on a 1.75 of VO, and as I was leaving the boat, I met my friend Ralph again, and as I was leaning over the side of the boat, vomiting down the side, all the counselors from Lakeside were on the boat that night, and I hadn't known it, you know. And I remember a couple of them walking by just shaking their head, and they were, you know, rumors that my success probably wasn't in the bag, you know. But I stayed in school, you know, and I graduated high school, and I met a girl a couple months before I graduated, and she was as dysfunctional as I was, and so it was like, you know, I mean, bang, it was perfect, you know. Neither one of us knew what we were doing. We were both lost. We needed each other. And we got married, and she got pregnant, had a baby. She got pregnant, had a baby. And, you know, and the whole time I was drinking and using I wasn't a good person. I wasn't functional, you know. I was violent, and I was uncaring, and I was lost, and I was scared, and I was full of fear, and I didn't know what I was doing. And that's kind of the way it was all throughout my 20s, you know. I had this huge hole in my chest, and I kept shoving everything into it that I could, you know. With a rum and coke being the main one, you know. I was standing outside, and I was a little worried about coming up. I was real worried about coming up here, you know. And then I realized I've showed my ass in front of all you people at the bar before anyway, so it doesn't really matter, does it? You know. You know, you see me do a lot stupider things with a lot less clothes on, okay? And what happened was I scared her off and we got divorced, you know. And then I wandered around St. Louis for a while until I found the next victim, you know. And took her hostage and made her believe that I was Mr. Wonderful. And except there was always that thing I would... Something would happen, and I would add alcohol, and it was crazy. It was out of control, and I wasn't a good person, and the second one, she wasn't a good person either, and so we fit together just perfectly, and we were married for a dozen years, and it got crazy, you know, I did a lot of stuff that I was very remorseful for and very sad for, but it's not that way anymore. And what happened was we ended up getting divorced. You know, there were a lot of charges ended up being filed by other entities of the government besides the IRS. I ended up absconding from justice and going on the run. And I found myself in Chandler, Arizona, and in 1998, I found the cure for alcoholism while I was sitting on a bar stool at the corner of Dobson and Elegant. Really, it's methamphetamine. And it'll let you drink all night and all the next day and all the next night and all the next day. I mean, it did that for me, but I kept drinking and drinking and drinking and drinking. And what had happened is over the years, you know, I had, what I had done was I had those two kids, you know, the two kids that I kind of mentioned at the beginning and haven't talked about since. That's kind of the way my life went. I was so ashamed of my behavior that I was less than a man, because I was never a father to those kids. I always let them down, you know. There were thousands of times that I called and I was on my way to pick them up and I didn't show up. And I somehow meandered out to San Diego, you know. What happened was it was the farthest point away from St. Louis, and the land ended. You know, they had already seized my passport, so I couldn't conventionally go anywhere else, and there was water. I couldn't swim very far. And so what I did when I got out here, I had worked before as a bill collector. Go ahead. You got, the groan can come out now. And so what I did when I got out here was, aside from cross that border and go get a bunch of alcohol, $2 a pop down there and, you know, all that stuff, I got a job out in La Mesa. This guy gave me a job, and I started making some money, you know, and every Friday I'd get paid, and I'd get on the trolley, and I loved the deal. I'd get on the trolley, and I'd go south of the border, and I'd pick up a carton of cigarettes, some cheap whiskey, a couple other things that's not appropriate to mention, and I was set, you know, and that's kind of the way it worked for a while, and I started getting these big commission checks, and I was trying to repair, you know, I keep in touch with that first wife, and she'd give me updates on the kids, and I always had that remorse, that overwhelming feeling of less than because of the way I treated the kids, because I wasn't there for them. And I did that for years. I'm going too fast. I got to slow down. All right. We drove back to St. Louis in reverse. Now, what happened was when I had that job, things were going pretty well. You know, I mean, things were going as well as they could with me being involved in the picture. You know, I kept, I'd get some checks and I'd get a little money, and my life revolved around whatever that check was, as big as that check, whatever I could buy with one check. That's what my life was going to be reflective of. If I had to save $5 from that check to the next check, it would never happen, ever happen, you know. And I realized that, and not long ago, that whenever I was on my own and I rented an apartment or a house or anything like that, after the first month's rent, after the time that I got into the apartment, every time the people had to institute proceedings against me the second month to get me out, because I never once voluntarily paid the rent. I couldn't get the money together. I couldn't make it from there, point A to point B, without coming up with a great idea on how I was going to make more money out of that. And so, anyway, I was living in National City at Division and First Street, riding my bicycle to the 47th Street trolley, 43rd, 47th, right through Shelltown every day. I looked like a neon light riding through Shelltown, let me tell you. And getting on the trolley and riding out to La Mesa and working my job and touching base with my ex, you know. And my daughter was growing up. My son, he had washed his hands of me. He was done. And I didn't blame him, because I would have done the same thing if I was his dad, if he was my dad. But my daughter, you know, she was always daddy's little girl, right? I could never do any wrong. I get a little emotional when I talk about her, but what happened was, it was her sophomore, junior year of high school, you know, and she came out here, and I had bought a truck, and I was renting a room from this guy at Forest Park Apartments, and I could put it together and make it look like I had it going on. Hell, you can pull the wool over the eyes of somebody from St. Louis, let me tell you, okay? You're living in sunny SoCal, you got a vehicle and an apartment, you got it going on, let me tell you. And so at least I pulled the wool over the eyes of that little girl, you know. And what happened was she wanted to come out for her spring break, you know, and I thought it was a great idea. Maybe I could repair some of the wreckage that had been done in the past. So I spoke to my ex-wife, and we figured it out. She came out, and I picked her up in my truck, and I took the week off, and we cruised up to Hollyweird, you know, because that's what you do when you're from St. Louis, you know. You go see the freaks because, you know, hell, you love that shit. And, You know, at Hollywood and Vine, there was this little store, the little shop there, and they had these dresses, and we bought her a prom dress, you know, and she got to go back to St. Louis, and she had the time of her life, you know, and she went back to St. Louis and had a prom dress from Hollywood, and, you know, and her dad was a superstar in her eyes again, you know, but I was, you know, I couldn't even hold it on the road, you know. I was still getting those big checks, but, you know, I'd waste every penny of it every weekend, you know, and I'd make the weekend last as long as possible into the week, and what happened was she my little girl said, hey, I want to come out to California and live with you, Daddy, you know, for my senior year of high school, you know. I want to be an actress, you know, and I was still playing the part, and I said, you know, yeah, honey, that's right, we can do this, you know. And what happened was that little stopover I had in Phoenix, I had picked up, I had a couple of interactions with the law. One of them involved 13 felonies, including manufacturing hard liquor, and some action with a gun and some things like that. I made plans for my daughter to come out, and she was going to come out on August 8th, and on July 3rd, what happened was that they kicked in the door. And they came and got me, and they extradited me back. Well, they took me downtown, and they were going to extradite me back. And what happened was my boss came up, and he took his gold American Express card out of his wallet, and he gave it to him, and they ran it, and he put $5,000 on there, $50,000 bail, and he bonded me out, and I was in awe, you know, and he allowed me to. I was able to go face those charges in Phoenix. And what I did was, he let me out, and I borrowed a couple thousand from him. And he knew the plans that I had with my daughter coming out. And I went to Phoenix, and I walked into court, you know, and I told him who I was and why I was there. And they looked baffled, and they were like, "What? Nobody's ever walked in here voluntarily before, you know." And Arizona has a funky justice system. They dropped the charges is what they did, you know. They dropped the charges. But I was about $10,000 in the hole to my boss at that time. And I said, I'm out of here. And I was actually drunk when I went to court and they dropped the charges. I mean, I got a hotel room at the hotel in Phoenix where I did a lot of my stuff and couldn't even make it to court sober. But they dropped the charges and I came back to San Diego and didn't say anything to my ex-wife about that, and I didn't say anything to my daughter because I didn't want to be that guy one more time, you know. I couldn't break her heart. What happened was, August came around, and I had been checking with the courts because they had me a little worried, you know what I mean? Silly me, 13 felonies. And I found out on, like, August 2nd that they had reinstated the charges. They have an opportunity to file them three times in Arizona, one by the West Tempe Justice Court, once by the city of Phoenix, and once by the state of Arizona. I'm of the opinion they do it on purpose, but I don't want to go into that. But I was $10,000 in the hole, and I found out they had reinstated the charges, and I wasn't really in any position to walk back into that courtroom and say, I'm here to face charges now with my daughter coming into town in a week. So what I did was I said, hey, you guys got to come and get me. I really didn't say that, but I thought that in the back of my head, right? But the pressure was immense at that time. I was it's a lot of pressure of going to get my daughter was going to live with me for the first time. I had to be perfect. You know, everything had to be wonderful for her because I had been such a worthless guy the whole other part of my life that I wanted to be different this time. And what happened was, I flew back to St. Louis and we loaded up a U-Haul truck And I drove back to San Diego with my daughter sitting next to me. And I drove around Phoenix, let me tell you. I was hauling ass the whole way until I hit that Arizona state line, and I was 40 miles an hour all the way through. And we got here, and we had a little place in Spring Valley. A buddy of mine was an apartment manager, and I don't know off the 94 if you ever seen that sign that said, if you lived here, you'd be home now. Well, that's where I lived. I was home now, okay? And got her into West Hills High, and we got her a little car, and it was Nirvana. It was beautiful, you know? Except for I was involved in the situation, and that was a problem. The pressure, I knew the charges were out there, and I knew that they were coming, and I knew that, well, drinking was normal for people, so my daughter shouldn't have any objection to that, and I'll just go ahead and drink, and what would happen is she'd come home from school and find me just obliviated every day. Because the pressure from the charge, I knew that they were coming. I knew that I was going to go to prison. And you guys were here, and my little girl was here, and I wasn't going to be able to defend her against you guys. And that was my biggest fear. And they came. I was still working at that place in La Mesa, and they kicked in the door, and they put everybody, including my 85-year-old bookkeeper, face down on the carpeting, and they gaffled me up, and they took me over to the apartment, and they checked everything, and they hogtied me, and they were pulling me out of the apartment and taking me down to the van, and my daughter came home as they were pulling me out, and she spit in my face and said, I hate your guts. And I'd violated probation up in Orange County, so they threw me up there for a year, and then they expedited me back to Phoenix, and I didn't know where my little girl was. And I hated me so bad. And what happened is when I was in Maricopa County Jail, I'd been in out of these meetings my whole life because, listen, when you saw me drink, you said I needed Alcoholics Anonymous. It didn't matter who you were or what you knew, I needed Alcoholics Anonymous, okay? And in Maricopa County Jail, I found that I would do anything to get out of that cell, including going to those Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. Hell, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to Narcotics Anonymous. I went to every church group there was. I was a Latter-day Saint. I was a Catholic. I was a Methodist. Hell. You know it. I got it. You get me out of this place, I'll go. I went for there. I didn't even listen to anything they said. I was just looking to steal shit from the administrator every time, you know. Could I get a pen from him? Could I get a book from him? But please sign my paper, right? Please sign my paper. And I did that. I did that for a couple of years while I was facing the charges, while I was in Orange County, and then while I was facing the charges in Arizona. And what happened was my court date finally came, and when my court date came, I had a stack of papers. I mean a stack. And the judge came in. They had come to me with a deal prior to going to court. And has anybody in here ever been in jail before? That guy back there, you might want to move away from him. What happens when you're facing charges like that, at some point, after they do an evaluation of how you've lived your life, they come and they try to give you a deal. And usually they try to make the deal enticing enough to where you'll say, I can do that, right? Was that your experience? Yeah, they did that with him too. They came to me and said, we're going to offer you 17 years. Yeah. It made me think. It wasn't quite, you know, and what happened was, I went to court and I had a stack of papers. And I professed that I had found God, that I had been a victim of circumstance, that I wasn't from Arizona, that shit that they were cooking was nothing I knew anything about, and if he just gave me an opportunity to get the hell out of here, he'd never see me again. And the judge that came in, he comes wheeling himself in a wheelchair, and you know, we're all shackled together, you know, and they're like, oh, shit. It was a drunk driver that put him in that, you know, and so then we're like, oh God, we're done, you know. I mean, he could have been born in that, and I believe that it was, anyway. For 10 minutes, he looked at that report, pre-sentence report, and he looked at those signatures, and he looked at that, and I was praying the whole time. In Maricopa County Jail is the one with the pink underwear. Sheriff Joe Arpaio. I love Sheriff Joe Arpaio. I believe he's the one that got me sober. That's not the end of the story, though. What happened was the judge looked at that pile, and he looked at that, and the judge said, if you're going to leave this state, we're going to give you 5 years on paper. We're going to let you go, Mr. Dalton. And I was shocked. And they took me back. And the guy that was my roommate, he was entrenched in the Phoenix lifestyle. He had a couple people outside waiting to pick me up when I was done. And I wish my story of recovery started there, but it didn't. What started there was I was hitting a meth pipe while I was in the parking lot of Durango Jail. And but the great thing about it was. That was really the beginning of the end because I didn't have any more do-overs. What had happened my whole life was I'd crash and burn, get a DUI, get thrown out by my wife. Something would happen, and I'd always get a do-over. I'd dust myself off. I'd go in and talk somebody out of a job. After I'd worked there for a day or two, I'd convince them to give me some sort of paycheck, loan me something. I'd buy a car that would have, it had to have at least 10 months left on the license. If I was buying a car in November, it had to have a license plate that was at least good till September because I hadn't had a license in years and I wasn't going to be able to register the thing anyway. So I had to get the maximum I could out of that vehicle. Oh, and it had to be $500 or less. At that point, I'd start looking for you or you or you or you or you or you. I'd start looking to take a hostage, rent a room. And that was really easy for me. That's the way it went over and over and over again throughout my life. But when I got out of Maricopa County, it just wasn't working for me, you know? And what happened was, I limped back into San Diego, and that guy who told me he was holding the job for me said, guess what? I couldn't hold the job for you. And after being incarcerated for a couple of years, I filled out my unemployment papers. And guess what? They won't give you unemployment if you're fired for getting incarcerated. I didn't know that. And so what I did was I hooked up with some friends out in Spring Valley. You guys know where Spring Valley is? You know what they do in Spring Valley? Yeah. And I found my way to the bar, and I found my way to a couple other places. And I didn't have another do-over in me, so I was just messing around in Spring Valley. Staying up all night, hanging out at the man's house until I got kicked out of anywhere and everywhere. And so what would happen was I still had some I had something somewhere in there. I wanted to say pride, but it was just sheer determination, I guess, because every 3 or 4 days, I'd say, okay, I'm going home, and I'd take off down the driveway, even though I didn't have a home. I didn't want somebody to think I was living at their house, you know. And so I'd loop around back, and he had a broke-down pickup truck on about a couple acres, and it was on the far side of the acreage. And what I'd do is I'd swing back around, and I'd make sure I'd leave right at dusk so nobody would see me. And I'd swing back around to the truck, and I'd jump in there, and I'd take me a little. I'd lose consciousness for a few days is what I'd do. Get up and get out of there and come back and circle back around and come up the, you know, I wanted to circle back around the property and come up the driveway like it was a new day. Hey, how you doing? You know, I'm back. Yeah, I had to take care of some stuff at the house. Pay some bills, you know, sure. Yeah. Run my empire, right? You know, and what had happened while I'd been locked up, what had happened was one friend of mine came and saw me, and he came and saw me through the glass, and something had happened to me, and I told him I was thinking about taking the 17-year deal because I was guilty, that I had found this program, and that if that's what God wanted me to do, that maybe that's what I needed to do, and that I was free, and I was freer than I had ever been. And he couldn't believe it. But what happened was one of those days that I was leaving that guy's house, I went to the truck and I fell asleep and I woke back up and I was hungry and I didn't have anything. And I went back in the garage and I got a hammer. I got a ball peen hammer. Steve laughs about it, but it was a big, nasty ball peen hammer, let me tell you. And I had 50 cents in my pocket and that ball peen hammer. And the best deal that I had going on then was your shit. And that was the plan I'd come up with, you know. That's what I had devolved into. And I came up on this lady that was crouched down in the back, reaching in the back seat of her car, you know, and I was getting ready to do the deal, you know, and she spun around and she had a baby in her arms. And I dropped my hammer, you know. And I didn't know what else to do, and what I did was I went and got on the trolley I hopped the trolley and went out to LG's. You know where LG's tavern is? Right there off the trolley at Lemon Grove. You guys know where LG's tavern is. Don't give me that. Anyway, I know that they had 25-cent payphones there, and I had 2 quarters in my pocket, and I figured I'd get them both best bang for the buck. I'd have 2 quarters, right? And so I went and I dialed it. I could only remember 2 numbers anyway. So I called the first one. It was that guy that came and seen me while I was in jail. And he said, "Don't you remember? You were going to take that deal, man, and you were free. Don't you remember?" And he hung up the phone. And then the only other number I could remember was the guy's house that I was living at. He had a sister that had 15 years sober. And I could remember her number for some reason. And her mother had just died, and I knew she had inherited some money. And I figured if she had 15 years sober, I could run some game on her, right? Right? She's perfect for the next victim. So I dialed her number up. And I tried to bullshit her, and what she said was, "It sounds to me, Greg, like you need to pray." Click, and hung up the phone. And that was my last quarter, and the desperation that overcame me at that point was unbearable. And as I turned to walk away, walk to the trolley, I heard a voice in the back of my head, and it said, "You dumb son of a bitch, maybe you need to listen to somebody just one time in your life." And I didn't know what that voice was or who it was, but it was God, you know? And God cusses, just to let you know. And I hopped on the trolley, and I went out to... Anybody know where Emerald Park is? Emerald Park used to be a really nice park. And it was September 9th, 2003. And it was one of those sunny San Diego days. and it was full of kids and people, and I hated everybody's guts. And I went in the bathroom with my backpack full of dirty clothes, and I took out my cleanest dirty clothes, and I took a little bird bath, and I changed clothes. And I came out, and I sat down in the middle of that park, hating everybody's guts, and I said, God, please. And I felt something touch me in the back of the head, and I had a spiritual awakening at that moment. And I knew that if I stayed out of the bar and away from the dope house, that God would relieve me of this insanity. He would take the monkey off my back. And that was the last day I used. I went back and I jumped on the trolley and I took it down to a place that I know and you all know, 1111 Island. And I went there and I knocked on the door and I said, I'm ready, let me in. And she didn't even look up. And I said, hey, it's me, I'm ready, let me in. And she still didn't look up. And as I turned to walk away, there was a door on the other side that was opened. And I was like, wow, maybe it's a sign, right? So I walked through that door, and as I walked through the door, a guy was walking out. He said, what do you want? And I said, listen, man, I'm here, and I'm ready. And he said, this is my last day as the director of 10 Day. We don't usually do this, but for you, we're going to let you in. Wow, huh? And they let me in, and I sat in 10 Day, and for the first day, you know, I was grateful, and for the second day, I was smoking your cigarettes, and on the fifth day, it was like, here I am, what are you doing for me, you know? And what happened was this little sawed-off run of a guy. That's my best friend. Came in, and he told his story, and he told his story about being down on Fiesta Island. And the cops gave him a ride off of there, and they gave him 35 cents so he could use his payphone, and he looked at that payphone, and that payphone looked back at him. He lived here all his whole life and didn't have a single number to call, you know? And at that moment, I knew that somebody else in this world knew the loneliness that I knew. And I said, man, I've never had this before, but will you please be my sponsor? And he said, yeah, here's my number. Call me when you get out, you know? Wow. And what happened was, you know, you're in 10 Day, and you're anticipating the next move. You're making plans, and they got that door there that they got that glass door that you can see through where they got that pool table, payphones, and women. And I wanted those things, okay? Not necessarily in that order, okay? But what happened was I was getting ready to get out, and they said, here's your referral. And I said, all right, where is it? They said, you're going to Father Joe's. And I said, what? That's a homeless shelter. And they said, oh, yeah, don't worry. We got you a spot down there. Just go down there and stand in line. I said, hey, can I use your phone? Because I got this number, this guy right here. I'm going to call him. He told me to call when I get out. He knew you were going to do this to me. And so I called him up, and I said, hey, man. Can you believe it? They've been messing around this whole time I've been here anyway. They're not even working hard. So they told me to go down to Father Joe's, and he said, yeah, I lived there 44 days. I stayed clean. Get your ass down there. Fuck. He's fired as a sponsor. You know, and I grabbed my stuff, which wasn't my stuff, because it was your stuff. You had donated to VOA, okay? And I ran down there, and I said, please give me a room, and they did. And God blessed me again. He put me right next to this guy that was probably 450 pounds, and every morning at 3:30, he started snoring, and it was like a chainsaw. And instead of messing around down there, what happened was he woke me up, and I got up and got out. You know, and I got out and I went to meetings. And I got out and I was a part of the program. You know, and I didn't know what the hell I was doing, you know. But I wasn't picking up. I wasn't drinking. I wasn't going to the... I mean, I still saw all those places, you know. I still saw us in there, you know. And I still thought about it. But I knew there was no solution in there. And you guys told me to just keep coming back. And somebody told me to jump in somebody's pocket and just act as if and come with you. And I did. And what happened was, you know, I copped a bunch of resentments, but I kept going to meetings. What happened was one day I got into Sobriety House, the place with the pool table, the pay phones, and you guys, you know, half of you, you know, the women. And I thought you guys were the answer. I didn't know you were the problem. I was the problem. I was the problem. I know. Believe me, I know. And what happened was after 22 days down at Father Joe's, they let me into Sobriety House, and I moved in there, and I was there a couple months, and I was a recovery guru. I knew it all. I had a sponsor. I was working the steps in the lunchroom every day. Well, every week, every month, whatever. And I was there a couple months, and what happened is, you know, what usually happened is I was there, you know. And even in recovery, I could still screw shit up, and I found that out. I broke the golden rule. You guys, you know. You know who you are. And I messed around, and what happened was a counselor found out, and I knew I was getting busted, and it was a Sunday night. And I knew I was getting thrown out the next day, and I was standing on that blacktop parking lot, and I was just beating the shit out of myself. You dumb son of a bitch. One more time, you screwed it up, you know. And I was smoking Marlboro Reds, and it was taking me two or three drags, and I was sucking it down. You know, and that trolley kept coming by, and that trolley goes right. It goes right to the spot where none of us need to be, right? We know where it goes. And, you know, I wanted to crawl back under that rock that I'd crawled out from under, you know, and another Marlboro Red. And what I did was I said, you know, I'm going to try this program. And I went and I got on that payphone. And I called that lady that I knew that had 15 years, and I was honest with her, and I told her what happened. And she said, what's your sponsor's name and phone number? She said, I'll call you back. And she called me back in 10 minutes. She confirmed my story that I was actually a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was working the steps, and that I had remained sober for 90 days. And she called me back, and she said, Greg, I'll rent your room. You can move in tomorrow. Don't worry. You don't have a job. That's okay. I hung up the phone. I was like, wow, this thing works, right? You know? And I was still feeling less than, though, you know? And what happened was I got up the next morning really early, and I didn't want to get thrown out on my ass again like I always did. And what I did was I got the newspaper, and I got on the trolley, and I started looking through the newspaper for jobs. And I saw this job in there for a bill collector. I said, hey, I've done that before, you know? And so I got on the phone, and I called out there, and this woman answered the phone, you know. Hello.
Hello. I am calling in regards to the job.
I was unaudible at that. By the time I was done, I was trying to get so deep with my voice, you know. And what happened was I scared her, you know. And she said, well, hold on. And she put me on hold, and she went into the vice president's office, and she said, hey, this guy scares the hell out of me. He can't work for me, but you might want to talk to him. And he said, okay, I'll take the call. And he took the call, and he says, okay, I'll see you. Come on in right now. You know, I told him. He said, come on in right now. I'll bring you in for an interview. And what happened was, what I say is I vomited a fifth step on his desk right there. Yeah, oh, my God. It's exactly right, because I told him the good, I told him the bad, and I told him all of the ugly. And he sat there dumbfounded with his mouth open. And when I was done, he said, listen, you don't have to tell anybody in this company that story ever again. He said, but I'm going to give you a job anyway. And so I went back down to VOA. And as I was walking in, the director was walking out, Tom Roach, a friend of mine today. And I said, Tom, I'm moving out today. And he got a big smile on his face, and he said, all right, Greg, good luck to you, and keep in touch, you know. And I had a little dignity. And what happened in recovery, what's happened since that time, you know, is, you know, I took the number 71 to that job for years, you know, and I made it there half an hour early, and I'd smoke those Marlboro Reds. Found out later I was known as the T-shirt and the smoking guy for a long time. Because I'd be smoking them, okay, in my T-shirt. And God's blessed me. With a year clean, I walked my daughter down the aisle. With 2 years sober, my daughter and my son were both in my wedding. That woman that I scared the shit out of, she became the next victim. She's the most wonderful woman I've ever met in my life, and I love her to my core, and I'd do anything for her. It's not about the stuff. I'm the vice president of that company today. I have friends in my life. Friends were people that I knew that I hadn't stolen their shit yet. Okay, that's the way my life was forever. And today, friends are people that I love that I'm willing to do anything for. I love you guys. You've given me a home. When I got into recovery, I hadn't had that license for 13 years. I wanted to rent a room and maybe get a license, but I didn't think I was going to get a license. So if somebody would have rented me a room, I would have been way ahead of the game. I consider all of you people my friends, you know. And listen, I came to these rooms loaded for a lot of years. I came for other reasons. As long as I had an option, I took it. But I just kept coming back. God forgives. He blesses us alcoholics, and He loves us. Thank you for having me here today.